And we're back. It's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and our guest is David Himbara, and he is the author of a great book, Kagame's Economic Mirage. And also, I urge you to go to David Himbara's Twitter account because he's up to date about Rwanda. And are you there, David?
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be with you, Phil.
Well, I'm very glad to be talking to you because something finally dramatic has happened in Rwanda that took us, a lot of us, by surprise, or is taking us, I should put it that way, by surprise. And that is that a very brilliant person, young woman named Diana Wigara has said, and she lives in, I guess, Kigali, she says she wants to be president. She doesn't like Kagame's government. She says that it is corrupt, that the people are poor, they're not developing, that they're actually impoverished, and that the leaders are lying about the conditions there. And she would like to see freedom, political freedom, and ability for people to have opposition parties, et cetera. But she has put herself to the front, and I know you are very struck. Tell us by her. Tell us who she is and your reaction to this news.
Well, first of all, I have to say that regardless of the outcome of the election, Diane Rigala has already won. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? Here is a country where no one dares speak about any issue. Mm-hmm. This is a country that has been blocking people coming to participate in the election, making sure that there is only one man standing for the election. Then out of the blue, here comes Diane Rigara, calm and collected, a 35-year-old human rights activist who announces that she's going to run for presidency. That is absolutely shock to everyone, especially to the system.
Mm-hmm. Now, and by the way, we were speaking to David Himbara, and he knows wherever he speaks because international police organizations have reported accurately that his own life was threatened. By the way, you have to be one of the people who can testify how courageous this young woman is.
This young woman, yes, of course, I was there. I had to flee from Rwanda to South Africa, then I had to flee from South Africa to Canada. As I said, this is a totalitarian regime that has been making sure that no one else but the incumbent, Paul Kagame, competes basically against himself.
People who've spoken up and people who said they wanted to be candidates or tried to form parties have been found dead. The Green Party lost several leaders. Victoire Ingabire remains in prison, and all she did was say she wanted to form a party. We should say that Diane Wigara, she has an interesting history. Her father was at once a very prominent man in Rwanda, and he died under suspicious circumstances. Tell us who he is, who was.
Yeah, here again is something very interesting. Diane Rwigara's dad, Arsene Paul Rwigara, was killed 2 years ago in a mysterious auto accident. But the family disputed the official version.
Mm-hmm.
The family, again, really did something unusual. They openly challenged the government to account. Mm-hmm. Normally in Rwanda, as you just said, when something happens to somebody, people accept and keep quiet. Whether they're in prison or disappeared or dead, people just accept and move on. But the Rwigara family said, no, this man was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And how did the government respond? It responded actually by demolishing that we got a hotel in Kigali.
Demolished it?
Yes, a hotel. Claiming that he never had any license to build it. So usually the response of this government when it's challenged is to come to hammer the family or whoever into silence. But after demolishing the hotel, now then we got our daughter said, "I'm coming for you. I'm going to challenge you for the presidency because you're not a good leader."
Yes. By the way, one of the words she chose, which I liked because it isn't often used in politics, but she says they're mediocre people.
Well, she said, you know, here, this is what happened. After she announced that she was going to run for presidency, the regime panicked, and then they put photoshopped photographs of this young woman naked.
Yes. You know history, and I know you're starting to write a lot about it now, and people should go to David Himbara's Twitter account, but this is sort of an old trick in Rwandan politics, to try to shame people.
But in this case, it backfired, because, you see, she didn't give up.
Yes.
She said, "Oh, I'm so disappointed. I thought I was running against real serious people. But actually, I'm so disappointed. They're so mediocre." So, you know,
that's the meanest thing, you know, you can say to someone.
Yeah. She said something else. She said, "Look, I thought we were going to play like a real soccer game with the referee according to the rules. But you see, these are just amateurs."
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, am I right in? There's two things we need to know about, I think. One is, I'm seeing speculation that they're not going to allow her to be on the ballot. They will think of a trick. And then the second thing I noticed when I tried to do preparation for today to talk to you, David Himbara, is that it's like a blackout. There's no recent discussions with her, or interviews, or reportage.
Oh, that is a surprise.
You do speak Kinyarwanda.
I do.
So it could be that there's quite a bit of discussion, but certainly the media here is not picking this up or reporting. Maybe they're startled or don't want to think about it. But what about that? Is she going to be allowed to run, do you think?
Definitely, the regime will try all sorts of tricks to make sure that she doesn't run. But so far, she says that she has met all the requirements. She has 600 signatures, collected from all districts in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So far so good. And I think that the regime was surprised. You see, normally what the regime does, it preempts people before things go too far. But she played a smart game, and she's now she's known. The regional media, the other day, the East African newspaper, the East African newspapers have picked up the story. The ambassadors in Rwanda, U.S., Germany, the European Union, have voiced their concern regarding, electoral regulation, really challenging the government to stand up to its own laws, allowing people like Diane to compete.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good. And she says all is in order.
Mm-hmm. So, by the way, this has to happen soon, right? It would have to be. Isn't the election scheduled for June or is it July?
The election is the 4th of August.
4th of August. So,
yes.
So the paperwork and the campaigning all has to be done June, July. I guess they make the determination in June whether she's going to be permitted.
Yes. June. By end of June, we should know.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, let's go back to her father. He had been a prominent supporter of the Kagame, if I'm right, the Kagame government or the RPF, but he was saying or doing something, which at the time that he mysteriously died. Are we to understand that there might be a serious division of opinion within the ruling circles of Rwanda right now?
Yeah, basically, what you have in Rwanda there, you have the government of Kagame comprised mainly of people who came from Uganda, who led the struggle from Uganda. But the people like Rwigara were Tutsi from Rwanda, who were originally from Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And a man like Rwigara took serious risks to be one of the financiers of RPF, and he was doing that from within Rwanda, really taking a risk.
Mm-hmm.
But now, people like Rwigara, being a successful businessman in the previous regime, have been targeted by the RPF regime. Some of them have fled.
Mm-hmm.
So Rwigara, before his death, he was resisting, these forced share of between his business, mm-hmm, and the official businesses of RPF. Most businesses are forced to contribute,
mm-hmm,
but he resisted. He says, "No, look, I supported you when there was a struggle, but now this is a mature economy. Now this is about a private enterprise."
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to play games.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, we know what happened.
Yes. Well, by the way, we're speaking to David Himbara, and it's in your writings that you point out that he and others, I suppose, ran into a political organization that turned out also to be an economic monopoly. My understanding from reading your book is that Kagame thinks that he can, if you have a business that's doing well, he can take that for himself.
Yeah.
Kagame's Economic Mirage, I should say, is the title, by the way. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, they have, the regime has this, the ruling party, RPF, has the Crystal Ventures is the conglomerate that controls most businesses in Rwanda. So, really, any businesses that pose competition to Crystal Venture has some difficulty from the government,
mm-hmm,
and Rwigara was resisting to play along with any kind of association with Crystal Ventures.
Yeah, and coming back to the daughter, and just to conclude, she. No doubt, the group that her father represented, they would be looking upon her with some favor, hoping to open up the economy to other people than Mr. Kagame, right?
I think all the Rwandans, I would say, really most Rwandans are looking up. She has done something extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
People in Rwanda, but even in diaspora, are afraid of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Because even out here, if you say something critical, then your own family ends up in trouble in Rwanda. Basically, the population is hijacked.
Mm-hmm.
But here is a woman who said, "No, I'm no longer. I'm actually tired of fear, of hiding under bed,
uh-huh,
to express my views." To talk about repression in this country, to talk about poverty, he says no, enough is enough. I'm going to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So she has really given people courage to stand out, to stand up and start talking.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with you, and I'm glad that you have been writing about this. And they're going to be making the decision soon, and so I think it's our job and even responsibility to make sure we talk further about Diane Rwigara and her prospects. Thank you very, very much, David Himbara.
Thank you. Phil, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share some ideas.
Yeah, we always like to talk to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. David Himbara. And again, his book is Kagame's Economic Mirage. I have it on good authority. He's going to have another new book, probably equally to make Paul Kagame unhappy, I think, would be the prediction.
And Phil, there's a quick check at Google says this is another story that the Western press somehow is overlooking, this candidacy.
That's why people tune into CIUT. Yeah. See? No, it is. This is big. This is the Great Lakes region. This is the best known name, for good or ill, in the region because he was a general and then he was glamorized and all kinds of, by the way, the lies about Paul Kagame and Rwanda have just become a mountain. And then someone like Diane Wigara speaks up and it's cast suddenly. It's just like, you know, the lights are off and then suddenly you see a bunch of things just because she spoke. It's like a lightning flash and you say, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that mountain was there. Yeah, very, very inspiring, actually. We will be talking to David Himbara and actually many others because all the elements that over the years Taylor Report has spoken to, and by the way, we've spoken to practically everyone. Kagame never speaks to us. I don't know why. But anyhow, they all now are going to have to rearrange what they want to say. Because, frankly, we all were somewhat surprised at this. And the first thing to wish her is good health because there are bodies all over the place in Rwanda, people who try to speak up. Finally, you recall, the Toronto Star, after years of being somewhat associated with and friendly toward the Paul Kagame, had to come forward and say, and did very exemplary, that just some really ugly things happened there, and it was much. And their reportage involved the threats to the life of our guest, David Himbara. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM, and Phil Conlon is back from Europe, where they treated him very nicely. And he pointed out he isn't always treated that well elsewhere. Phil, there is some news that we should probably chat about it some. One of the little things that happens in journalism here is that they like to say, well, this is the anniversary of this and this is the anniversary of that, you know. So today, I believe, the New York Times and the Globe and Mail is reminding us that this is the day of the Tiananmen, they call it, massacre. And that was a misreport from the beginning. And they like to say, and they got this is where they trap themselves, people who do propaganda. They said it was the Tiananmen massacre. And the New York Times at the time, and it was 1989, if I'm right.
That's right.
And that a demonstration that had gone on for weeks was finally the government said, okay, enough of use of the public square of our country. You have to leave. By the way, if you were to attempt such a thing in London or Washington, D.C., you would not last a week. They would come and remove you, as Dwight Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur once removed violently the bonus marchers from Washington, D.C., and killing some of them, burning their camp, driving them out. Because, they said, you can protest, but you can't occupy. So there was this demonstration. And all of the leaders of it, by the way, have retired to London and Washington. And many of them went to Harvard where they became drunk and disorderly, and proving that they didn't amount to roller pins as political people. But they had this word massacre in Tiananmen. And the New York Times, to its total shame, claimed that bodies were burned in Tiananmen at the bottom. They have a monument there and they said they burned the bodies. Total malarkey, complete. Go and look it up. There's now authoritative academic books so that you can feel safe and you won't be pecked on by your professor. But look it up. There was violence, but not at the square, because they and the troops came in and they did not use they were not using weapons because the students, let's remember, had agreed to quietly leave the square, which they did. However, anybody who's been associated with big demonstrations knows that there will be factions, for reasons known to them or foreign intelligence, will not go along with what the leaders decide, because the situation is too massive. You don't have a proper structure. So the leaders say, okay, we're leaving, but somebody wants to be the local hero can say, I'm not leaving. But they didn't use tanks. They didn't use soldiers. They cleared them with unarmed soldiers. However, nearby and in late hours of the night and the following day, some groups decided to have a confrontation, and it wasn't the army. The army had people killed there. The Chinese army lost people. And yes, ultimately, in subduing that element that wanted to fight, some people were killed. And I leave it to the lawyers and a bunch of other people to decide who started what. But there is, if you were to go back to Paris Match, of all things, I was working in Europe, and Paris Match did a photo spread of all this. There were some really ugly things done by these factions that wanted to fight. And they did kill, and they did it in a vicious way, soldiers who they managed to isolate and then beat to death or run over them and did various other things. So the Tiananmen matter, as it was resolved, was not a massacre at Tiananmen. It was, yes, violent. But all that was totally exploited, turned into a propaganda game, which to this day the Globe and others all put on a solemn face and they say, oh, the massacre at Tiananmen, because that's a phrase. They're wedded to a phrase which is based on false information, which they propagated. I think it was Sulzberger, perhaps, the New York Times, actually created this story, which he had to later acknowledge was not true, that they had burned the bodies of the students. Because, after all, they had created a false story. And so the villain has to do something villainous. So somebody said, oh, they burned the bodies. Well, they just said, well, let's go with that because it sounds true. Since you've already said, you know, that you're dealing with a demonic government that doesn't respect blah, blah. And so they decided to go with the rumor. And that's always been fun for publishers, all the way back to William Randolph Hearst, who started the Spanish-American War. You know, you send me the pictures and I'll make the war. And in this case, there was no pictures, but they made it anyway. And they said, oh, that happened. So it's being commemorated by the people who still can't tolerate the Chinese running their own government. And they would be in Hong Kong and in Taiwan. And that's the unfortunate thing we're left to live with, is this false report. So I'm telling you it's false. And you look it up. And we might talk about that sometime in the future. But there's been a lot of documentation. You know, the simplest way to get the truth on this one is just go to the Chinese government, which can be trusted as much as you can trust the Canadian, believe me. Definitely, believe me. And they compiled reports. It's a government. They have newspapers, good newspapers. And they said, here's what happened. And they had the pictures and blah, 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 and all that. And if somebody had just paid them the minimal respect for China as a country and as a people, they would have, reporting would have been entirely different. But no, they're viewed as suspicious, dubious, odd, cruel something Asians, and therefore you can just it's a blank sheet, you can write anything you want on it. No respect at all for what the Chinese themselves said. Which takes us to Moscow, where we have Mr. Putin just on the weekend gave an interview to Megyn Kelly, who was chased down the hallway by Mr. Ailes, who now is ailing, pardon me, dead. And Megyn Kelly has got her whole career now she's at NBC, am I right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so,
but she's still back there at wherever she came from.
Her head is still at Fox.
Yeah.
And but she did, at least she did this thing, which is now not permitted by most journalists, Western journalists. She actually spoke to Putin like he is the president of a country and is allowed to answer questions and to expand on it without somebody prompting her to interrupt him and yell at him. And they had a good discussion. But President Modi, or is he Prime Minister? Prime Minister Modi, I guess. I don't know. India was sitting there. It's very interesting to watch. Did you see? Do you watch those? The Putin.
I haven't seen the whole thing. I've seen a little bit of it, but it's it's very meaty. You really got to concentrate because there's a lot of information.
And absolutely.
When Putin talks, I mean, he's got something to say, and he gives you chapter and verse. You know, he doesn't talk in just like vague cliches that mean everything or nothing. You know.
You're right. I think that the American political leadership, and that includes Obama, who people think of as a good talker. To me, he's a kind of an act, but he does use cliches tremendously. And then the only thing he does is add a pause, which is supposed to give them weight. You know, let's pretend it has some gravitas, you know, by breaking a sentence into four or five pieces. But I do think that the American leaders are really galled that President Assad of Syria and President Putin of Russia speak more clearly and with greater command of the file, as the lawyers say, than they do. They all have prompters and little notes and don't forgets and make sure that you just hammer this point and, you know. Whereas, particularly President Assad of Syria, our listeners, I would urge you, just go and be honest and let the man speak. And the same is true in the case of President Putin. You would like to understand what's going on. Listen to them. I'm not saying that everything they say is absolutely so, but if you haven't listened to them, paid clear attention, you won't have a clue. And all you will be doing is repeating the common cliches of the day, which are all leading us towards armament and wars. We're in a very dangerous situation where now we must hear from these leaders. But I was just speaking of China. Their leader is equally someone who has reputation for detailed knowledge of this subject. He made a great comment, by the way, about dealing with Trump. He said, they said, did you talk to Trump? Trump says that you're robbing and that you're ripping off America and all kinds of things about your China in trade. And he said, you know, talking about trade with the Americans is like playing a lute in front of a cow. that's helpful. So it turns out he not only has command of the file, but he has a certain sense of, literature or whatever it is that brings that sort of that.
You know, he's married to a musician, right? So he's he knows music, right?
Maybe he plays a lute.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what was happening.
He went out and played a lute for the cow to see how it reacted. That looks familiar.
This bovine figure with the funny hair kept staring at him, and he thought, well, I'll entertain it. I'll play a lute. Well, on that odd note, which is the appropriate word, no pun intended, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're very grateful to have Carol here today, and we'll see you next week.